Please make comments, ask questions tonight if you got any. All right. Last week, I heard you had a good class. Thank you, Troy. I don't think he's here, but thanks to Troy for filling in. He said he was going to cover two chapters. I heard he only covered one, so but that's okay. We're going to pick up our reading in Matthew chapter 16 tonight. Matthew chapter 16. It's been a good study so far, and we're going to hopefully cover chapter 16 tonight. Looking for Jeremy. I don't see Jeremy here. Jeremy is my scholar for Pharisees and Sadducees. So if you got questions about that, you should see Jeremy. I was hoping he could correct me. All right. Matthew chapter 16, we're going to read the first four verses here. And the Pharisees and Sadducees came, and to test him, they asked him to show them a sign from heaven. He answered them, "When it is evening, you say, 'It will be fair weather, for the sky is red.' And in the morning, 'It will be stormy today, for the sky is red and threatening.' You know how to interpret the appearance of the sky, but you cannot interpret the signs of the times. An evil and adulterous generation seeks for a sign, but no sign will be given to it except the sign of Jonah." So he left them and departed. We haven't talked a lot this quarter about these groups, the Pharisees and Sadducees. We mentioned them. Jesus has had several encounters with scribes and Pharisees. We haven't mentioned Sadducees much so far. We had a brief discussion about the synagogue a few weeks ago, and we did mention that in the New Testament, Pharisees and Sadducees just kind of appear in the readings. We don't read about them in the Old Testament. When we think about the Old Testament, we read first about the fathers that God talked with. We read about the tabernacle and the leaders of the clans, the families. We read about the judges, and then we have the kings. We read about the temple and the priests and all the laws and the high priests and all the things that go along with the things that happen at the temple. When we get to the New Testament, things shift a little bit, right? We read a lot of things going on around the synagogue. We don't read a lot about the priest's engagements. We read a lot more about these people called Pharisees and Sadducees. Read some things about Essenes. So who were these people? The Sadducees, we'll call them the old money, if you like to think of them that way. They were the people who rubbed elbows with the high society, with the ruling class, the Romans. They followed the written law. They would not follow the oral law that was given down and later written as what we'd call the Talmud, as the Judaism would call it later on. They denied the resurrection. They denied the eternal blessings of heaven and damnation. They did not believe in eternal beings like angels. The Pharisees, on the other hand, we would consider them more the new money. They were of the people. They were the wealthy business people, the merchants, the traders. They were the leaders that dealt with the common people. Both these groups, using their positions and influence, both parties developed power and prestige in this society all around the synagogue, and they made up what was called the Sanhedrin, and it was kind of this court, if you will, to make rulings among the people. But the Pharisees and Sadducees, they didn't really get along, and really a lot of it came down to this idea of the resurrection and believing in the afterlife or not. So, when we get to this section in Matthew 16, the fact that they come together to test Jesus speaks volumes about Jesus. That they're going to put this aside to come together to test Jesus and ask him for a sign. It tells us that Jesus was a threat to them. So you have the Sadducees who are representing the upper echelon, the ruling class, and you have the Pharisees who are representing their power over the people. Both of those are being threatened by Jesus. That speaks a lot about what Jesus is bringing to this, to the party, if you will, and what how he is threatening their power over society. They come to him and they want a sign. And this is very similar to what we read in Matthew chapter 12 when the scribes and Pharisees came demanding a sign. His response was, the only sign you're going to get from me is the sign of Jonah. And we talked about that then, so I won't dive in deep to that. But he gave them that comment, and it seems like he left them and departed. So this is what you're going to get. I already told you this once. I'm out of here. So comments from you about this section. Okay. Let's read on this next section. Verse 5, chapter 16. When the disciples reached the other side, they had forgotten to bring any bread. Jesus said to them, "Watch and beware the leaven of the Pharisees and Sadducees." And they began discussing it among themselves, saying, "We brought no bread." But Jesus, aware of this, said, "Oh, you of little faith, why are you discussing among yourselves the fact that you have no bread? Do you not yet perceive? Do you not remember the 5 loaves and for the 5,000? How many baskets you gathered? Or the 7 loaves for the 4,000? And how many baskets you gathered? How is it that you fail to understand that I did not speak about bread? Beware the leaven of the Pharisees and Sadducees." Then they understood that he did not tell them to beware of the leaven of the bread, but of the teaching of the Pharisees and Sadducees. So when they get to this other side, Jesus gives them a warning and says, those guys that were just talking to me, beware those guys. Those are some bad guys, is basically what he's saying. Beware the leaven of those guys. They're bad news. But all the disciples, all they could hear, they're only thinking about what they can see, and what was on their mind was, oh no, we forgot the bread. And now he's talking about leaven. He's talking about bread. We're in trouble. So Jesus, I can see Jesus. He's just shaking his head. Guys, come on. Is that how you see it? That's how I see him. And just in disbelief. Like, come on, guys. Really? Is the 5,000, the 4,000? I can do bread. You know, it's they couldn't see it. They didn't remember this. This is one of the most astonishing passages to me in the New Testament. In chapter 13, we talked about how the kingdom of heaven was like leaven. And that was a good thing, right? But here, leaven is used what seems to be a bad way. Somebody talk to me about that. How is the leaven of the Pharisees and Sadducees a warning?
It's an evil
influence.
The church and Christians are a good influence. Anything that influences one way or the other, it can be good and it can be bad. It's like TV. TV used to be a good influence. Now, anything you turn on, it's a bad influence. There's all kinds of things that can be good and bad.
Yeah, absolutely. Vincent?
That's probably a lesson to be learned out of 47 and Acts. It only takes a little bit of it and multiplies. And you listen to the teaching of these influential Pharisees and Sadducees, that will have a tendency to multiply. It would not be the teaching of Jesus, but their person.
Yeah, those who could not hear the comment, is remember how leaven works. It can just be just a little bit how it spreads. And that reminds me of gossip too, right? So And that game you play as kids. So you start at one end, you say something, and you try to repeat it, and how it grows and explodes to something completely different. My girls love playing that game. How earlier they were saying how Jesus was of the devil. You know, just that little gossip, right? And then that could spread, right? If you're sharing that and saying, I heard this, and there's no basis to it. Mark?
So the Pharisees' leaven here starts out as I said, very small. This is a few questions of this new rabbi. You know, as far as the people are going, they're out there just challenging, making sure that, you know, it's right. But there's a seed in there that's, you know, of course, there's some jealousy, but they started very small, just asking questions. But of course, where did it lead? It led to killing him. So the leaven, the growth of that influence was started very, very small and on that really, really big.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Yeah, and how I was trying to point out earlier of how these people came about, right? These were not people appointed by God as necessary leaders of his people. These were not the priests, but these became these spiritual leaders in society because they decided that they were those in charge. They decided to be the people in charge. They became the teachers and the rulers themselves. Thank you for your comments. Good. Verse 13. Now when Jesus came into the district of Caesarea Philippi, he asked his disciples, "Who do people say that the Son of Man is?" And they said, "Some say John the Baptist, others say Elijah, and others Jeremiah, or one of the prophets." He said to them, "But who do you say that I am?" Simon Peter replied, "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God." And Jesus answered him, "Blessed are you, Simon Barjona, for flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father who is in heaven. And I tell you, you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it. I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven, and whatever you bind on earth shall be bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth shall be loosed in heaven." Then he strictly charged the disciples to tell no one that he was the Christ. So they've moved north a bit. So Caesarea Philippi was about 25 miles north of the Sea of Galilee. They reached this place. Jesus asked his disciples, "Who do people think that I am?" He's got to know that he's stirring up a lot of chatter. He's doing signs. That's getting people talking. People are going to be thinking that he is somebody special. They're talking. So who do people say that I am? And they got ideas, right? It's going to be one of these prophets. But he calls himself the Son of Man. And this isn't the first time. Calls himself the Son of Man. Have you thought about that phrase before? There are over 80 references in the Gospels where Jesus refers to himself as the Son of Man. I didn't know that it was that many until studying for this. Over 80 times he calls himself the Son of Man. What does that phrase mean to you, the Son of Man? It's on the spot. I didn't tell you to study that. Just what does that phrase mean to you, though?
He's a man.
He is a son of a man.
He's not a God.
Say again.
Ezekiel's reference to Son of Man, he's called the prophet. That's kind of what jumps on
him. Ezekiel called himself Son of Man as well many times. As well. Can I read that for you? Daniel 7, verses 13 to 14, what David is referring to. I saw in the night visions, and behold, with the clouds of heaven, there came like one a Son of Man. And he came to the Ancient of Days and was presented before them. And to him was given dominion and glory and a kingdom, that all peoples, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion, which shall not pass away, and his kingdom one that shall not be destroyed. I assume that's the verse you're talking about. Okay. What was your comment, though? It's double meaning. Yeah. Any other comments? Yeah, I read it as both as well, as being someone who is human, almost this phrase of humility, but also one that is appointed, right? So Simon Peter, again, as we pointed out, is the one who speaks up, right? And that's no surprise there. I know when you read these, you probably visualize some of these scenes in your mind. I see Jesus sitting and his disciples in a crowd, and Peter's kind of in the back, and they're saying, Jesus says, "Who do people say that I am?" And they begin to answer, but he says, "Who do you say that I am?" And Peter, he makes his way up. He's right there in the front. He's like, "You are the Christ," right? He's always right there. "You are the Christ. You are the Son of the living God." He makes this great statement of faith. What does this mean? That you are the Son of Man, the Christ. It means Messiah, right? The anointed one. At the beginning of this gospel of Matthew, we had the lineage of Jesus that showed out his kingly lineage, right? Where he came from, and he was rightly in the lineage of being a king. But Jesus calls himself Son of Man here, but then Peter, which almost seems like a flip side, right, calls Jesus the Son of the living God. So Son of Man, Son of God. I like that kind of balance here. Son of the living God, which also is in great contrast to where they are. They're in Caesarea Philippi. This is a city throughout history was known to be a center for worshiping idols. For decades, it was the center of Baal worship. When Greeks took over, it was to worship their god Pan. And now it is named Caesarea Philippi. I can't say that word. Named by Philip Tetrarch to honor himself, if that's not idolatry, to worship himself, honor himself, and Augustus Caesar. So we have the Son of the Living God here in a city that was known to be worshiping false dead gods. So I like the contrast here. Jesus acknowledges Peter's statement and declares that its revelation is from God. So I like that. That says, this is true, and you know this because it's from God. This didn't come from human flesh. This came from God. Any comments about this part? Okay. Verse 18. It says, and I tell you, you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it. It's perhaps one of the most debated passages in all of Scripture. Roman Catholics would use this passage to defend the idea that Peter was the first pope. The name Peter, translated, means stone or rock. So what is this relationship between Peter and this phrase, on this rock, I will build my church? If it is referring to Peter himself as the foundation of the church that is built upon Peter himself and he's raised to this elevated position, do we see Peter throughout the rest of the gospel and the scriptures that we have? Is he elevated in any way to give us that belief? Can you think of anything that may be contrary to that? Bruce? I think so. Yep.
Is masculine, where on this rock, the drop is feminine gender. And so they're not even the same gender, but even he says upon this rock, he's talking about upon this bedrock, upon this foundation. And that foundation is what, referring back to what Peter has just said, you are the Christ, the Son of the Living God. That's the foundation that Jesus is talking about.
He's saying on that confession of faith that Jesus is the Son of God is that foundation. Okay. Any other thoughts, comments? Bruce? Branson? Yeah, so Paul withstood Peter to his face. So you would think that if he's the Pope, he wouldn't have done that. Yep, that is one of the things that I wrote down that would make him more fallible, if you will. Yeah. Bob?
The Greek word translated Bob literally means huge ledge. The Greek word translated Peter means small stone. So the huge ledge is the confession Peter made that Jesus was the Christ. And then they want to say that Peter, Jesus talked to Peter, and he said, very delusive.
That's right. Yeah, I had that down too. Yeah, so just to list a few of these things about Peter, Paul does correct him in Galatians 2. He is a fallible man still. Jesus is going to rebuke him in just a couple of verses we're about to read, right? He calls him, "Get behind me, Satan," in just a few verses. Peter is a spokesperson for the Jerusalem church. He seems to be in an elevated position there, but he is sent by the other apostles and must give an account of his actions on behalf of the Jerusalem church there in Acts 11. In Acts 15, with the Jerusalem council, Peter is there. He has a voice on the council, but it is James who cast the decisive vote or voice there. In Revelations 21, the illustration of the church was built on the foundation of the 12 apostles. Peter is, again, a central figure in the establishment of the church, obviously a very central figure. But then, as we read the narrative of the New Testament, Peter kind of fades to the background, and we read of other characters and other strong people of faith that we can read from. After Acts 15, we don't read much of Peter, other than the other writings of Peter. So again, some people say that this Peter's confession is what is the foundation here. There's a lot of validity to that as well. Jesus is the chief cornerstone, right? We read that in Ephesians chapter 2. So, any other comments about these statements? Yeah, David.
Yeah, so Peter calls himself in 1 Peter 5, fellow elders.
Mm-hmm.
So whatever he was saying to the elders that he was addressing in 1 Peter 5, he's saying that applies equally to me.
All right.
And then Jesus, there were several people in Jesus' ministry that bowed down before Jesus, including Peter.
Right. He wouldn't accept that worship, and he shouldn't have. But yeah. In verse 19, Jesus says, "I will give you the kingdom, the keys of the kingdom of heaven, and whatever you bind on earth shall be bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth shall be loosed in heaven." Peter got the keys of the kingdom. Is that unique to Peter? Do we know of anyone else who has the keys of the kingdom? We do as well. Anyone who has the keys of the kingdom can let people in or can shut people out. We read in just a few chapters, Matthew chapter 23 and verse 13. The scribes and the Pharisees, they also had the keys of the kingdom. They could share the good news to others about God. And what did they do with the keys of the kingdom? In verse 13, "But woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you shut the kingdom of heaven in people's faces. For you neither enter yourselves nor allow those who would go in enter to go in. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you travel across sea and land to make a single proselyte. And when he becomes a proselyte, you make him twice as much a child of hell as yourselves." So, we all have the keys of the kingdom. It's what we choose to do with them. It's kind of like the fruits of the Spirit and what we choose to do with the talents that God gives us. We have the keys of the kingdom, just like the scribes and Pharisees did here. Any other comments about this section here? Yes, Dave.
You know, the way Jesus described when he called himself this church foundation, the church of Pepto, which means the Lord, the way he describes that really shows you it's not talking about Peter, it's talking about the Messiah, because he said that upon this rock, Pepto, I will build my church. And the church is an ecclesia.
Right. Good comments. Rance?
Right.
Right. Branson mentions this point in verse 20 where he charges them not to tell others that he is the Christ. Remember, it was just two chapters ago that when Jesus was walking on the water, he came in the boat, they all worshiped him as the Christ. So this shouldn't have been just a statement by Peter. All of them should have been at this point already, especially after all they've seen. But Jake. It does. Doesn't deny it. Yep. It does. Yes. I think that's a good comment. Let's continue reading verse 21. And from that time, Jesus began to show his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem and suffer many things from the elders and the chief priests and scribes and be killed, and on the third day be raised. And Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him, saying, "Far be it from you, Lord. This shall never happen to you." But he turned and said to Peter, "Get behind me, Satan. You are a hindrance to me, for you are not setting your mind on the things of God, but on the things of man." This phrase from that time marks a pivot in Jesus' ministry. He's kind of leaving this Galilean ministry period and is beginning his journey to Jerusalem now. This will be the first of four times we'll have here in Matthew where Jesus predicts his arrest and death, his crucifixion. Peter doesn't like what he's hearing from Jesus, pulls him aside and says, no, this isn't going to happen. And Jesus gives him a sharp rebuke and says, you still don't get it. Even after this great declaration of faith that you are the Christ, he still thinks he knows better than Jesus and how this should go down. To make it even more clear, we have this next section about how Jesus must suffer. Making mention of the cross. In verse 24, then Jesus told his disciples, "If anyone would come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. For whoever would save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake will find it. For what will profit a man if he gains the whole world and forfeits his soul? Or what shall a man give in return for his soul? For the Son of Man is going to come with his angels in the glory of his Father, and then he will repay each person according to what he has done. Truly I say to you, there are some standing here who will not taste death until the Son of Man comes, until they see the Son of Man coming in his kingdom." So he gives us three reasons why we should give up this world and follow Jesus. First, he says, if you lose your life for him, you will find it. The second one, What good is this world if you lose your soul? They don't compare. It doesn't balance out. And third, you're going to be repaid for what you've done. So three solid reasons why this should make sense and why you should follow Jesus. Comments and questions from anyone about chapter 16? Josh?
I love that last statement, verse 28, giving us a sense of when the kingdom is coming. It's not a question mark of how long it's going to be. Is it going to be 2,000 years from now, or 5 days, or, you know, he basically says there are some here that's going to see with your own eyes.
Right. So what is this, right? What is this coming of his kingdom? Is this the second coming of Jesus? No, because these people would still be alive today, right? So what is this second coming of Jesus? Then there are different people's interpretations of what this means, right? Was this the Jesus' transfiguration, when you see the Son of Man coming in his kingdom? Is this his resurrection, the coming of the Spirit of the Pentecost, the spreading of the kingdom of the church? It's at hand.
It's at hand. The kingdom is at hand. And he's saying, y'all are going to see it.
Yep. Thank you all very much for your comments. We'll cover 17 next week.